I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is poet Barbara Jane Reyes. We are going to talk about her latest collection of poems, Invocation to Daughters. You may have heard of Barbara Jane Reyes before. She's a very well-known poet. She's out of the Bay Area. And this is her first time on Words on a Wire, so I'm very excited to talk to her. We have met in social poetry circles before, but this is going to be the first time I've really had a chance to sit down and talk to her. So stick around, and we'll talk about Invocation to Daughters. Barbara Jane Reyes is author of multiple books of poetry, including Invocation to Daughters, Poeta in San Francisco, which won the James Laughlin Award, Diwata, and To Love as Aswang. She's also the author of multiple chapbooks. She's born in Manila, Philippines, and raised in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I'm very happy to have her on the show to talk about her latest book of poems, just put out by City Lights, called Invocation to Daughters. Barbara Jane Reyes, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And congratulations on this what, your fourth book?
It's my fifth, actually.
Fifth book. It's an amazing book that's getting a lot of attention, a well-deserved attention. And one of the things that I read was from Publishers Weekly. And they say, Reyes fuses elegy, psalm, prayer, and the language of protest as a challenge to hegemonic, patriarchal, and colonialist narrative making. What do you think of that description of your book?
Yeah, it's big. It's big, but you know, when I read it, I thought, oh my gosh, people get it. You know, I've always been a little bit of anxiety being a Philam author, you know, Filipino-American author, and not knowing that people will ever understand exactly where I'm coming from, right? And in the past, you know, as with one of my previous books, Poeta in San Francisco, you know, I felt like, you know, for all of the folks of color who were and who still are very thankful for the work, people are still writing about that book and talking to me about that book.
Oh, it was a great book.
Many years later, there was backlash as well from folks who thought that it was very anti-white, it was white bashing. And I kind of thought, well, you know, when you're coming from this person of color or an immigrant perspective or the perspective of somebody who comes from colonized places and colonized communities, you have to see the rage, you know, and you have to understand it comes from somewhere legit.
The book is opened with an FAQ, the frequently asked questions, which I loved in itself. It's a great way to enter into the book. You have this number three, why are you so angry? Don't you ever smile? And then the answer is, why aren't you angry? Why does my outrage inconvenience you? And, you know, being a person of color that went through the MFA at the University of Oregon when the diversity was just changing. This was years and years ago. Andres and I were often confronted, Andres Montoya, he was my classmate, we were often confronted with that question. It was really irritating, but I love your answer. Why aren't you angry?
Right, yeah. And I think that, you know, I wonder if, like, Americans are catching up with that sentiment now.
Yeah.
You know, we're living in a very interesting and volatile time in American history. We've been at war for almost two decades now, and I think that Americans, you know, which isn't to say you and I are not American, but, you know, like, I think folks are starting to understand that anger is valid,
right?
You know, back in, you know, a few years ago, or at the time that Poeta was coming out, at the time that you and Andres were just coming out of school, and, you know, all these things are happening, and folks kind of didn't know what to do with the anger of people of color. And I still think today a lot of folks in our own communities are very uncomfortable with that because they know the experience of having, you know, the majority tell us, what are you complaining about? You're here now, right? You're in an MFA program. You grew up in America. And, you know, you have nothing to be angry about. And that's many, many ways of, I guess we use terms now like gaslighting, right? So I feel like the mainstream is kind of catching up by using these kinds of terms.
I forget what gaslighting means.
Yeah, gaslighting is when you look at somebody who is oppressed, and you are the one who is oppressing them, but you put it on them and say, you're imagining this.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you're responsible for your own state because you're imagining it. I'm not doing anything to you.
And, you know, there's something interesting that you referred to earlier about other Filipino writers being kind of disturbed by your book and by the way you use your poetry to really speak out and address a lot of really important issues. I'm wondering if once you begin to establish yourself as a Filipino writer or as a Chicano writer or as a Latinx writer or as a whatever kind of writer outside of the mainstream from an oppressed group, if the first rejection comes from, you know, refer to Lorda de Cervantes' poem, to the white man in the workshop who wants to know why I, a well-educated, et cetera, et cetera. If it shifts from that to people from our own community, especially writers from our own community who may perhaps more want to fit in.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is all anecdotal, so I really don't know because, you know, I grew up here in the Bay Area, which is much, much different from these larger centers of publishing power in this country, right? And so that, for me, is my advantage, right? That distance, right? And, yeah, these days I wonder, you know, does that kind of fear from folks in our own communities come from, you know, this idea that we're going to ruin it for them, you know, that, all you Filipinos are angry, all you, you know, folks of color are just so angry and writing in these languages we don't understand and talking about these historical contexts that we have no kind of knowledge about or interest in, that is going to ruin, you know, how our you know, writers in our community are perceived by the larger industry. And I feel as though that's such a scarcity mindset. We, you know, I think that publishing has gotten a lot more, it's gotten larger. You know, there's the huge publishing houses, and they're only going to take a certain type of narrative or type of poetry, or that's not really something I concern myself so much about, with the exception of, you know, it's a bit of a digression, but I promise I'll come back. You know, there is an editor at Penguin who is putting out a lot of really amazing classical Filipino work right now, Elda Roder at Penguin Classics. And, you know, like, so those are the things that I do pay attention to. But, you know, when I'm looking at my contemporaries, I'm looking at a huge field, and I'm looking at how we're thriving in the independent publishing scene.
You know, and publishing is so different now than it was even 20, 30 years ago with, you know, with so many different books coming out and the burden being on the author to promote her work as opposed to, you know, used to be the publishers would promote work. And there's just so many books out there that that a writer needs to create a community. And the community that we belong to, and I know that you and I share some communities and a lot of writers of color share communities, but it seems that when you're in that community that the opposite is true. Those who are more bold and assertive tend to gain respect from their colleagues.
I should hope so, right? Because it's a lot of work. It's so much emotional labor, right? And yeah, there's only so many hours in the day that you can dedicate to this kind of work at putting your stuff out there and hoping to find connections with readers. And whether it's via social media platforms, which most of us use, or, you know, like I don't have the energy anymore to, you know, couch surf and, you know, go to different parts of the country and read and places where, you know, where I don't know too many people, but it's always, you know, it's always a good thing to, like, you know, find yourself in a bookstore or in a college or university in some part of the country you've never been to and make a meaningful connection with a student or a reader, right? I wish I had more energy to do that again, but I don't. Yeah, so from this home base here in, you know, West Oakland, what can I do to kind of keep reaching out? So I do use social media a lot that way.
Yes, and I follow you on some of your social media, and your voice is not silent. You're always out
that.
There.
I appreciate hearing that because sometimes it feels like a vacuum too, right? But yeah, there's definitely something that I learned from, you know, I mean, I see my elders doing it, but I remember specifically Eileen Tabios, who's one of my mentors, and she's based here in Northern California as well, you know, who had said, right, to promote yourself, well, she had said a few things about, you know, self-promotion, one thing being to promote yourself, promote others. So that's right. One way of having a community or growing a community. But I think also just, you know, practicing community, not just saying, oh, we're part of the same community because right. we are of the same ethnic group, but rather just really through the work of reading and of teaching and of talking about one another's stuff and, you know, supporting younger writers coming up.
Right. Yeah, you know, that reminds me of the reputation that Rigoberto Gonzalez has earned in the poetry community, especially the Latinx poetry community. I mean, he's, you know, he's such an important voice, but he spent a lot of his energy in his career promoting young Latinx writers.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I saw him speak at the first Canto Mundo retreat. Mm-hmm. You know, I had accompanied my husband, Oscar Bermeo, you know, to that, and got to listen to Rigoberto speak there about, you know, about practicing community. And, you know, he also has been such a big inspiration for me. And I remember when Poeta came out, and Poeta in San Francisco came out, and it won the Laughlin, and it was a big deal. The first thing that Rigoberto said to me via email was like, this is so awesome, congratulations, what are you doing next? Like, right away, I was like, I don't even have time to rest, right? So, but rather than just kind of feel exhausted by that, I really let that motivate me.
Yeah,
you know,
that's great. This new book, it's Invocation to Daughters by Barbara Jane Reyes, a book of poems from City Light Publishers, just came out. It's a powerful new book. And you have this quote in one of the poems, Consume. You have a quote by Roque Dalton.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite quotes in all of poetry. And it's in English, it's often translated as poetry like bread is for the people.
Yes.
La poesía es como el pan de todos. And you also have a quote by Arlene Viala, who is an amazing poet and is one of the most, you know, I don't know, I just think she's a fantastic human being.
Yes.
But Roque Dalton, it reminds me of when Andres Montoya and I first started getting into poetry, he would carry around the clandestine poems. And there was a quote that he used to always say to me. And I don't remember if it's directly from a poem or if, you know, if I'm paraphrasing it, but he says that Dalton writes that the poet is either a clown for the oppressor or an enemy of the oppressor. And I'm wondering how you feel about that idea and what responsibility do poets and even especially poets of color have to speak out with their poetry?
You know what? I really like the idea of the poet as a clown. you know, at first I thought, would I be insulted by that? Probably my younger self would be. But one thing that I do appreciate about the clown or the trickster figure, right?
I like that.
Is the way that that trickster figure looks at the social conventions and just says, F this, and just messes it up and disrupts it.
Oh, my
right?
God.
So in many ways, we look at the clown or the trickster as that figure that shows us how ridiculous we are to, you know, have certain such social conventions that keep everybody kind of in line and fearful of stepping outside of that, right? So, my younger self would definitely be insulted by thinking of the poet as the clown, but, you know, now I'm thinking I really do appreciate the ability to disrupt. And then also to take, you know, let irony and let satire do the things that they're supposed to do,
right?
You know, sometimes I feel like, oh, gosh, wouldn't it be nice if I didn't have to feel responsible? And I put that upon myself to feel like I have a responsibility as an author. Wouldn't it be nice if I could just write poems about nature and poems about, you know, I'm constantly, like, finding all of this peace under the redwoods here in Northern California. And then I think to myself, even writing about being in nature becomes a social commentary.
Wow.
I don't know how many people tell me, because I'm constantly posting my hiking pictures, they say, how come it is that so many people think folks of color don't belong in the natural world? Right? And I'm like, because we all don't have the leisure time, or we are all supposed to live in the slums and in the ghettos? Or, you know, like, I don't know exactly where that perception comes from, because I see all kinds of folks of color, right,
yeah.
out there in the natural world. But how did that become white space,
right?
And I think about, like, you know, let's go back to Carlos Belloson, right?
Right.
Folks of that generation and of that labor class who were, you know, they were tending to the earth.
That's funny. I was just in a conversation yesterday when somebody was asking me if I ever read Fat City, because somehow Stockton came up. And I go, no, but I've read Carlos Belloson. And he had never read him. And I thought, well, that's if you want to hear about Stockton, that's a fundamental text.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Carlos Belloson. And it's like, well, if you want to know about Stockton, if you want to know about California history, if you want to know about West Coast American history, right? And the history of the workers as well.
Right.
So Belloson is great that way. So I you know, I also kind of think, going back to your question of responsibility, this thing has happened where I've been publishing for a while now. I've been teaching Filipino Lit and Filipina Lit at various Bay Area universities. And young people really, like, you know, at first they come to you kind of fearfully, or they see you from afar and they're fearful of you, and then they come in and they want to know everything.
Right.
They want to know, how did you become so brave? Right. And that's something that, as a Filipina, constantly being told not to speak, I see that same struggle happening with my 18, 19-year-old Filipinas, right? Just
right.
starting to understand that they do have a voice and that they can use it. And they look to me, and immediately they're calling me ate, right, which is elder sister in Tagalog. And you know, I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm instant ate to all of these young Filipinas who, you know, who tell me, we've never seen anybody like you before.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing that you're still being told that, you know, after we've been writing for so long.
Yeah. So it's, you know, like every semester, you know, you're discovered again.
Right. You know, I want to go back to that brilliant answer about Roque Dalton's quote.
Oh, the clown, yeah.
You take that image of the clown and you empower it rather than weaken it.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that's a wonderful way to read that and to reinterpret it. And it's a very, I don't want to give it a label, but it almost is there's more complexity than the duality that we're given in the conventional narrative, that they're, you know, that we could take those images and rework them and use them to empower.
Absolutely.
And even a very postmodern, I guess you could say, approach to that duality. It's fantastic, because you have empowered, you know, even the idea of being a clown. What can we do as a clown?
Absolutely, right? We think about the comic relief, the person who is always the butt of the jokes. And then, you know, and I see that and I'm like, I don't see necessarily a pathetic figure there. Sometimes I really do see somebody who is serving a social purpose by switching the mood in the space.
And the trickster. You use that term, trickster. I think that's fantastic, because in essence, a poet may have to be played the trickster.
Yeah, absolutely, right. Craig Santos Perez, right, he has those Juan Malo poems that come from his Chamorro tradition, right?
Uh-huh.
And we have a Juan Tamad in Philippine tradition. Juan Tamad Tamad means lazy in Tagalog, right?
Uh-huh.
So we have this folk hero, and see, I'm using the term folk hero very deliberately now, who was depicted by the Spanish as somebody who is beyond lazy. Just the native is so indolent that he will sit under the guava tree and wait for the fruit to fall, right?
Wow.
Rather than, you know, pick it off the tree. And, you know, and you think about, like, how so many of us as immigrants are told we have to be industrious, we have to work hard. And then you see that kind of resistance that Juan Tamad is just, you know, shamelessly performing.
Oh, I love that. Waiting for the fruit to fall. It's a beautiful image. And,
yeah.
You know, it kind of reminds me of the image of La Malinche was a duality 20, 30 years ago. And it was a very male duality, you know, traitor and loyal and traitor, like those are the only two things. But the Chicana feminists have reinterpreted La Malinche.
Absolutely, right? And I think that it does have to start with, like, what is that colonial archetype of the native?
Right.
How do we flip it around? And then once folks have kind of gotten accustomed to seeing the other side of that, then you can start to tease out all of the details, right?
Right.
For me, I really love this Juan Tamad, and I, you know, I look at some figures in my own community, and, you know, and I've been writing about my father a lot since he'd passed away.
Right. And including in this book, there's some powerful, powerful images of your father.
Yes, it was so cathartic. It was so necessary, right? It was definitely part of my grieving process to be able to sit down and just write everything, however emotionally, like, difficult it was, just put it all out there, right? So I'm still writing about him, and I probably will for a very long time, but I'd been thinking about, like, recasting in my mind the way we look at, or the way I look at his, he had so much stuff. He was like a master of salvaging stuff, right? And, like taking stuff apart and making new things and having those things fail and having some things be brilliant too. And I was like, isn't that my poetic statement?
Wow.
You know, just kind of dealing with found materials and taking these canonical truths, quote unquote truths, right? My big scare quotes, and like messing it up, like really just kind of finding something else in that. That becomes my statement of, like, poetic experimentation as well, is dealing with all of this old junk.
You know, to say Invocation to Daughters, you know, is a collection of angry poems is really missing out on the love. There's so much love in this book. And through the language and through, you know, remembering those who have came before us and who have, you know, suffered at the hands of the oppressor, of you know, the patriarchal, there's the love of language, there's the love of the prayer, that kind of incantation, but also the fact that the father is a central figure of love really gives the book a lot more. You can't dismiss it. Just can't dismiss it as a book of anger or anything. And I'm wondering, at what point did the father assert his spirit in the book? Did you know that it was going to have that kind of...
I didn't, right? Because you can never predict when these things are going to happen. You can, you know, like, none of us knew, even though my father was never in the best of health, none of us knew when and how, right?
Oh, he died while you were writing the poem, the book.
Yeah, and so I had started out thinking about, and, you know, a young woman who had read my previous book, To Love as a Swung, had emailed me out of the blue, and I appreciate these emails that I get from random readers, you know, somebody I'd never met before, and she was saying, she was trying to work out her own ideas of the work, and she said, I feel like your poems have something to do with women's rights, you know, and I thought that's a great way in, because it really made me think about, like, what am I doing as a feminist poet, right? Like, and the more I kind of talked it out, and in my response to her, you know, I started talking about that these were poems that were trying to kind of respond to patriarchy. Right, and I was like, oh, there's the big word, patriarchy, right? But patriarchy literally means the rule of the father. So I was writing those poems in response to the rule of the father, right? So when you see these Filipina names come up in the book, you know, in my mind, I see them as having suffered at the hands of the patriarchy. And so these are the daughters that I was talking about.
Right.
But, you know, having this intense family experience really kind of got me thinking, because, you know, everybody wanted to, especially, you know, when my father passed, like, they wanted to know more about him. They wanted to know, like, you know, like, they just wanted to know everything. And it really got me thinking about, you know, the kind of static image I'd had in my mind for a very long time of who I thought he was had really, in reality, changed over time. And I hadn't had the space to think about that and articulate that, you know?
Right.
What does it mean for a Filipino man to raise four daughters? right? No sons. It was always a big deal that there were no sons in my family, right? And so it got me thinking, well, you know, here are some daughters that we need to kind of think about, and there's a father that we need to, that I am thinking about and seeing every day and seeing him decline and also thinking about his growth, right? And how we grew, like, you know, the kind of growing pains that, that we all kind of went through. And, you know, so I publicly acknowledged my father did change over time. Wow. He was somebody who said, my daughters are not like that, meaning this kind of static image of what a Filipina traditionally is supposed to be. And even though we fought about that, there was acceptance about it. And there was, he had a tremendous amount of pride for the kinds of successes my sisters and I have been able to accomplish, right? So, you know, in pretty non-conventional, in old school terms, non-conventional roles, you know, your daughters are not supposed to become attorneys and executives and professors. They're supposed to become nurses and wives and mothers. And, not, you know, like that wasn't something that we did, you know? So in that way, it was like, you know, let's give this man his credit.
Yeah. I've always loved your poetry. I just love your language, and I could follow it anywhere. So this book, Invocation to Daughters, it's the same. I love the language, and I love the incantation. I love the series of long poems. You have two of these long poems, and each section is named, and one section ends with the line or the image or the rhythm of the next section. I love how that just brings me in and doesn't let me go. But the curious thing is I underline, you know, things that just blow me away. And there's a line that I underlined, and I just want you to, maybe if you can just comment on it or something. It's under Orison. The line is, she is an absence manifest. That's such a beautiful and complex line. And I'm not even talking about the rhythm, how it fits into the poem, but just that she is an absence manifest. There's so much in there. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I absence manifest, it just reminds me of some images that I've seen, or just kind of this idea that the female is in a way kind of an absence and a male is a presence. You know, and I remember seeing some clay figures that this is a male figure, this is a female figure, and the male figure obviously is marked by its genitalia, right?
Uh-huh.
And so the female is marked by the absence of that, right? So I just remember that image. I couldn't even tell you where I saw it, but it stuck with me for many years. And, you know, and I feel as though there's been a lot of language in mass media about females being a lacking thing, right? Part of this absence manifest to me is like, what do we do with that open space?
Right.
What do we do with that empty space? And what do we do to acknowledge that we are seen as this thing that is not there, right? Whether it's, something as kind of simple and seemingly insignificant as my walking down the street and people walking into me because they just don't see me, you know?
Right.
And that's an experience so many women of color I know just...
Yeah,
we're not heard. We're not even perceived as there in the room, right? As a human presence. And so, like, and there's definitely anger to be had about that. But I also kind of feel as though, like, what am I doing in that space of absence? And in many ways, I feel as though some of my most powerful writing happens when I'm inhabiting that space of absence or invisibility.
Yeah, the term itself, I mean, it indicates everything that you said, but it's also very assertive to be a manifest absence, because it can't be absent because it's manifest.
Yes. So it's obviously a contradiction. So we kind of have to think about, what does that mean, right? Like, I am manifesting all kinds of things from that invisible empty space. Therefore, I am no longer an invisible empty space.
Right. Oh, you know, it's as great of a line, and I hope it lives as long as Mark Strand's line in The Field, I am the absence of field.
She is
the absence manifest. It's a brilliant line. I hope it catches.
Oh, thank you.
but we're running out of time, and I could talk about this book a lot more because I just feel like we just barely touched the surface. It's such a beautiful, important book. But I just have to ask you one more question before
sure
I leave. Is the Gap Band 4 really the best album ever?
Hell yeah. Come on, man. Remember the Gatefold LP? You open it up and it's all these pictures of the brothers in these amazing outfits. And I feel like every single song on that album is a high point.
Is that the one, does You Drop the Bomb on Me come from that one?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Awesome. You know, so there's those real super catchy tunes and then Outstanding, that song Outstanding.
Outstanding. I'm gonna write that down and listen to it.
Yeah, for me, oh my God, I have just so many great memories of just being however old I was when that album came out and being kind of on the precipice and, you know, and also at that time that I was just looking up at my sister, my older sister, for like, you know, just everything. And that was her album. And, you know, it's emblazoned in my head as like something very important that I learned from her. So I'm going to make her listen to this interview and she'll be like, Barb, I had no idea. Yeah.
Well, can we get you to read a short poem from Invocation to Daughters? Either, anyone you want.
Okay, yes, absolutely. And I'm going to read Psalm for Mary Jane Veloso.
We should probably tell, do you think we should tell a little bit about Mary Jane Veloso?
Yes, Mary Jane Veloso, I believe, is still on death row in Indonesia. She was somebody who was an overseas Filipina worker looking for domestic work and was recruited by some people who, you know, there are many stories about how so much heroin ended up in her luggage, but, right. You know, we're thinking that she was used as a drug mule. So, you know, she was the one convicted and, you know, has been in prison in Indonesia ever since.
Okay, let's hear it.
Okay. Praise the monstrous body, too enormous to describe. When the tongue is taken, how may the mouth even try? Praise the bitch-slapped face, the hemorrhaged eyes, the cluster, the clot. We send our blood. We run. We run, and we never look back. Praise the trafficked body, the one that is excised. On smartphones, with hashtags, we lament the phantom part. Praise the foreign object rushing to the heart. That is you, the help, the heroine. We pump our fists for you. Isang bagsak. Praise the ever-present lens. The firing squad shoots every curse and plea. Your breath is a miracle, a lifeline, a headline. The old you is dead. Praise for her soul. We offer to her our last lacrimosa. Praise the new you, the chrysalis, the secluded saint. Praise you. May you emerge, graced and gospeled, unjudged, unfallen, and the color of sky.
That was Barbara Jane Reyes reading from her new book of poems, Invocation to Daughters. Barbara Jane, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to thank Barbara Jane Reyes for joining us on Words on a Wire. The name of the book is Invocation to Daughters, and it is available anywhere good books are sold. I'm Daniel Chacon. I'd like to thank our producer, Lauren Terrazas, and we'll see you next week on Words on a Wire.